Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, Newark Today host Michael Hill has a candid conversation with retiring New Jersey Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman.
This is very frustrating to me. I think this is the evilest administration I've ever seen in my life, and I am burdened by it.
WBGO's John Kalish has the story of two brothers who grew up in Newark and served in World War II.
Leon Goldenson spent more time with more Nazi prisoners than the psychiatrist depicted in the new Nuremberg movie.
And film critic Harlan Jacobson reviews Wicked for Good.
At the core of this two-part Wicked and Wicked for Good is a liberal vision about race, or more exactly, skin color. Ariana Grande's Glinda the Good Witch is a cherry vanilla cheerleader, or make that Emerald City influencer.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Earlier this month, Democratic New Jersey Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman announced that she would not seek re-election when her term ends. In 2015, Watson Coleman became the first African-American woman to represent New Jersey in the U.S. House of Representatives. She spoke this week with WBGO's Newark Today host, Michael Hill.
Thank you so much for taking time to do this. You're retiring from Congress. Tell me why.
I've been at this a long time. I really feel that I am aging, obviously. Thank you, Lord. I want to spend time with family. I want to think about being relevant, but being in different space. This is very frustrating to me. I think this is the evilest administration I've ever seen in my life. And I am burdened by it.
Evil in what way?
Every way. Evil in intentionally inflicting harm on people by withholding resources and firing people and changing programs and refusing to feed people in this country or other countries. Failure to support the kind of research that makes people healthier. Allowing food and medication to be directed to countries in need, but letting it expire. Doing things policy-wise, and then that are harmful, whether it's Medicaid eligibility, Medicare, the cost of not of taking care of the ACA subsidies, and then going back to your doggone office and trying to figure out, well, now how can I do more to be harmful? I think that I've never seen government so weaponized against people so that rich people who don't need us at all to get richer and richer and richer. And for those rich people to put the money in their pockets, not even pay their workers that well. You know, at some point, just like, I can't take anymore this mess.
Do you think the voters last year leading up to the 2024 election, do you think they didn't know any of this was coming?
I think the voter that cares about humanity didn't think that we were getting our message out, didn't understand the value of having at least some of, not all of, but some of Joe Biden's principles and values advancing. I think they stayed home. Some of them stayed home. I think that other folks in the kind of red states thought, well, he's right. Don't let those folks get anything, and I'll make a bit of a sacrifice in what happens on my behalf, just so the others of color, the others of different ethnicities, the others of, you know, different origins, for them not to have. I think that he fostered a hatefulness and an otherness around people that we've not experienced before. And some people were weak enough to fall for it, and they voted for him. Now, what's happening with them? Their Medicaid eligibility is changing. Their Medicare is changing. Their access to healthcare is going, if they're doing it through the ACA, is going to be more expensive. He's not building houses. He is not sheltering people. He decided he wasn't even going to feed people. And now, as it's getting colder, He wasn't going to feed them, and he wasn't going to shelter them. That's evil.
Ms. Watson-Coleman, I have to ask you about Newark and other cities in New Jersey, Trenton and Paterson. How could they be helped? How can Congress help those places?
So let me start with Trenton. That's my home. I live right outside of Trenton. So Trenton is the capital of the state of New Jersey that is burdened by 53% of its property, or 58%, being a non-paying, non-tax-paying. The state of New Jersey and the federal government and the county government and the municipal government placing burden upon its infrastructure and its resources. The state of New Jersey is not putting the resources into it that it needs to. And the Congress has the capacity to be more supportive. The same thing goes for Newark on a different level. It's about resources. They got a brilliant mayor up there. They've done a lot of changing of the lifestyle and education and all that kind of stuff. But they need more money. They need more resources. And so towns and cities like that, we can take care of our own business if you give us the resources. We don't need paternalism anymore, Michael. We need just access to the resources. We could eliminate poverty. We could elevate living conditions, and we can ensure that there's a floor beneath which nobody has to live.
There's a famous picture out there, Ms. Watson-Coleman, of you arm in arm with the mayor of Newark on May 9th at Delaney Hall, the Immigration Center. Why were you there? Why were you supporting the mayor in this, and with the feds saying that they had to do immigration enforcement there?
I wasn't there to support the mayor. I was there to do my oversight duty, which is what we can do at these kind of detention facilities. It was the strangest one that I've ever attempted to do oversight in. There was a whole bunch of delaying and, you know, silly stupidness. I did know that the mayor had wanted certain inspections to take place, but they didn't do them. And so I knew that if we were able to get in, we'd be able to look at the conditions, and we could say yay or nay, that they did require this. Like, we got stuck on the elevator. The mayor had been trying to get an elevator inspection. When we finally got an oversight, we got stuck on the elevator. That was one thing. So we wanted to see the conditions of it. And then it turned into something else. So when you see my arm inside of the mayor's, it was when we heard, okay, we're going to lock him up. Even though he was on public property, not their property, they had decided that they were going to lock him up. My first instinct, hold on to the mayor. Do not let him be hurt. And so that's what you see. And you see LaMonica right behind him, trying to be in that space too. All we wanted to do was to make sure that Mayor Baraka was safe, because these people came at him. I don't know, it had to be 10, if not more, clothed in their fatigues. Some had their armaments on, coming after the mayor of the biggest city in the state of New Jersey on public property. It was hard for us to process immediately in the moment. So my first instinct, I'm a Black woman, I'm old enough to be his mother, protect the mayor.
What about your own safety? Did you have any concerns for your own safety and all that?
Hey, isn't that crazy? When you're in the middle of it, I had a heartbreak moment where I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. But I never feared for my safety.
Some of the issues you raised, healthcare that you've spoken a little bit about here, how does America, how does the Oval Office, how does Congress, how to address healthcare in this country they can afford?
Put the money in it. Eliminate all of the unnecessary eligible dimensions that they install as a deterrence and delay tactics.
Universal health care?
Me? I'm for universal health care. You know, like, health care is a right in this country. It should be a right. And everyone should have access to it. And how we pay for it, figure it out. Government, figure it out. I think insurance companies right now and PBMs are the biggest obstacle to this. And so, yeah, for me, I'm okay with health care for all.
I want to talk about the results of the election 2 weeks ago. Cheryl in New Jersey, Mamdani in New York City, Spanberger in Virginia, and of course, California redistricting. All victories for Democrats. What's the future of this party, the Democratic Party?
Tuesday was a good day because across the country, decisions were made that we want freedom, we want quality of life, we want fairness. We want people who care about us elected to office, and we want to make sure that we're not racially gerrymandering districts to reduce the number of minorities. That was a huge communication. For there to have been a cave-in that same doggone week, you didn't even let it settle in with people that there was hopefulness for tomorrow. So I am very angry that we made the decision, or I didn't make it, that the decision was made from people that I share a party affiliation with to allow themselves to be pulled into a discussion that didn't need to be had that week. Even if they had waited a week for a, just to let it settle in. These were successes. And we allowed that success to get drummed out by that carelessness that happened in the Senate. That's how I feel about that.
Mamdani ran in such a campaign. He's a Democratic Socialist of America member and so forth. The party establishment was slow or almost no endorsement. No endorsement from Schumer. Hakeem Jeffries endorsed him just on the eve of early voting. What's the messaging there? Mamdani ran a successful campaign in New York City with fresh ideas, new ideas, yet the party establishment was slow to endorse him or didn't endorse him.
The message is listen to the people. Pay attention to the people. They appreciate it and trust it. Mamdani in what he was saying he was going to do, what he would stand for. I'm glad Hakeem supported him. I don't care how late it was still on time. I'm sorry that Schumer couldn't. Mamdani represents the issues and the approach to the issues of today.
Why do you think Schumer didn't endorse?
I have no idea. Ask Moraine, let me know.
All right, let me ask you this last question here. What is your advice to Governor-elect Mikey Sherrill?
Recognize the fact that 95% of Black women voted for you, that 92% of the Black men that voted for you, that 70% of the Latino women who voted for you. Recognize that 53% or so of white women voted for you. Recognize that 45% of white men or so voted for you. Recognize that the people that voted for you expect you to stand in progressive spaces and that you have diversity at all levels in your appointments, and that your policies reflect what people want, and that is fairness, that is healthcare, that is housing, that is opportunity, that is social justice on all levels, and that government is supposed to work for the people that it needs to work for, and not to interfere with the people who can be wealthy by their creativity, but they can't do it at the expense of those who need government and its resources.
What kind of candidate, what kind of person do you want to succeed you in the 12th district?
Someone that shares my values. Someone that'll fight for the things that I fought for. Someone that believes in the floor issue, you know, beneath which no one should have to live. The social justice issues on all levels.
Ms. Watson-Coleman, thank you so much for your time. I hope to talk to you again.
Me too. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks to the retiring Congresswoman Bonnie Watson-Coleman. The Trump team says it does what it does to keep America secure and safe and strong.
You can hear the entire Newer Today show at WBGO.org. A story now about two brothers who grew up in Newark and became doctors, then served in World War II. The Goldenson brothers had very different wartime experiences. The older of the two worked with Nazi war criminals who were convicted at the historic Nuremberg trials. WBGO's John Kalish has more.
The recently released motion picture Nuremberg involves a real-life U.S. Army psychiatrist named Douglas Kelly, who spent 5 months working with the Nuremberg prisoners.
You are standing inside a secret military prison. It houses what's left of the Nazi high command.
See? Hey!
The governments of Russia, France, Great Britain, and our United States will put these men on trial for their lives.
It can't be done. There's no international law to base the charges on.
The world needs to know what these men did.
The psychiatrist portrayed in the movie was replaced by another Army psychiatrist named Leon Goldenson, whose family lived in the Clinton Hill section of Newark. He died of a heart attack at the age of 50, leaving behind a wife and three children. Decades later, a book of interviews he did with the Nazi prisoners was published. Here's an excerpt from the audiobook.
Leon Goldenson was an American physician and psychiatrist at the time the United States entered the Second World War. In 1943, he joined the U.S. Army and was soon posted to France and Germany, where he served in battles in the European theater. Not long after the war ended, he became prison psychiatrist at Nuremberg, the location of the first post-war trials of the major Nazi war criminals.
The Nuremberg Interviews was published in 2004. Leon Goldenson's kid brother Eli spent years working on the book. I spoke to Eli Goldenson when the book had just come out. It was a labor of love for the man he called the best brother in the world.
When he was a junior at Ohio State University, he would write reviews of the New York plays that he saw when he came home, Thanksgiving and Christmas. He once in a while took his kid brother, me, to see these Broadway plays. And when I went to college down at George Washington, he was starting medical school at George Washington. So I became one of his roommates down there.
Leon Goldenson spent more time with more Nazi prisoners than the psychiatrist depicted in the new Nuremberg movie. His book has been translated into 16 languages. Eli Goldenson told me that the Nazi defendants and the witnesses being held in the secret military prison respected his brother. The commander of the German Air Force, Hermann Göring, who is a major character in the movie, complimented Goldenson on his technique as a psychiatrist. I asked Eli Goldenson why the Nazis respected his brother.
He was fundamentally a gentleman, intelligent, and was able to meet them on any level.
Eli Goldenson's adult children helped with the book. His daughter Ellen, who had served as editor-in-chief of Natural History magazine, did copy editing and handled correspondence with the publisher. She was in awe of her father's efforts over 7 years to bring the book out.
He just never gave up. He just knew it was important, and he didn't listen to anybody's doubts, and he kept editing. He just went from publisher to publisher. And finally, he found a very fine publisher for it, Random House or Knopf.
Her brother Marty is a veteran of public radio newsrooms. He introduced his father to a famous baseball player who provided some advice on finding a publisher.
I was visiting him up in his house in Nyack with my friend Jim Bouton, who was a great New York Yankees ball player and famous for having written the book Ball 4. And so when Jim said, where are you taking this idea for the book? And he said, you know, Columbia University Press. And Jim sort of rolled his eyes. He said, no, no, this is an important book historically. It should be taken to a serious publisher with tentacles worldwide. Jim just raised his expectations, steered him away from the smaller world of university publishing. And Eli sure was glad that he did.
Ellen Goldenson said her Uncle Leon's work was prescient, given that it was done 17 years before the publication of Hannah Arendt's book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil.
When I read the interviews and I see what he did, it does give credence to that kind of Hannah Arendt theory of the banality of evil. For the most part, the people interviewed were very ordinary, so incredibly dull and ordinary, and felt what they did was quite excusable and just a normal part of their job, and seemed to have no concept of the enormity of their behavior. After talking to them, he must have been shocked to see how very ordinary they were and how ordinary human beings are capable of huge evil.
When Dr. Leon Goldenson pressed Hermann Göring on his culpability in genocide, the Nazis' response was that he couldn't do anything about it because he was busy with other things. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Wicked for Good finishes the story of two young witches who met in their witchcraft school days at Shiz University and struggle for the soul of the Emerald City of Oz in Munchkin Land. 2 hours and 18 minutes long for Wicked for Good. The first part of the movie launched last Thanksgiving to a big success at the box office. Our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, has a colorful review of part two.
Wicked won Oscars for both production design and costumes, which is what it should have won out of its 10 nominations last year that included Best Picture and performances by the two witches, Cynthia Erivo as Elphaba and Ariana Grande as Glinda, at the heart of what is the backstory of our great beloved American classic, the 1939 Wizard of Oz. This limited two-parter singular achievement is director John Chu's wrangling both the long-standing Broadway musical and Gregory Maguire's novel onto the screen as a lemon drop behind-the-scenes look at what was really going on in Emerald City when Dorothy from Kansas blew into town and smushed the Wicked Witch of the East. The Winnie Holtzman-Dana Fox screenplay, its rewrite of the original Wicked Witch of the West, Cynthia Erivo's Elphaba, is what this whole project's all about. She's green, meaning of color, and by story design, the only one gifted with talent and a compassionate heart seeking justice. The world has worked out for Glinda, not so much for the green Elphaba. The two are best friends and adversaries since Shiz, the Witchcraft Academy, where Glinda was popular and Elphaba had talent in a class full of dullards who presumably could pay tuition. In Wicked for Good, the grown-up Elphaba has shown up at Emerald City to take down Jeff Goldblum's update on Frank Morgan's original wizard, this time as a bumbling frontman for a creeping tyranny that Glinda sees but serves loyally. That's even after Madame Morrible, the former Chinese head of school and now the wizard's Goebbels, has rebranded Elphaba, her former whiz-bang witch student, as the grown-up Wicked Witch of the West. The Palo Alto-born director John Chu, son of immigrant Chinese parents, a father from the mainland, a Taiwanese mother, broke through in 2018 with Crazy Rich Asians and seems to have a feel for the steely glare of disapproving Chinese women. That the Asian is revealed as the real menace in the story, well, the best you could say is that at least this is a story about women and the men are useless. There's nothing as breathtaking as the green train that pulled into the station to carry Elphaba off to Oz in the first part, thanks to the FX team led by Pablo Hellman. Wicked for Good is still more of cinematographer Alice Brooks's light show framing of Nathan Crowley's gorgeous production design and Paul Tazewell's costumes than it is a memorable musical. This despite the dizzying octaves of Ariana Grande and vocal shockwave of Erivo, whose end duet, Good, is moving in the moment. But I'd be surprised if it generates much revenue for composer and lyricist Stephen Schwartz in better motel karaoke bars everywhere. Schwartz's songs serve the moment. But there's no one breakout song in this second film, like Don't Cry For Me, Argentina in Evita, What I Did For Love in A Chorus Line, or Memory in Cats. But this is good, and it's good enough.
I've heard it said that people come into our lives for a reason.
Here's the plan. I have no plan.
Well, I do.
Oh, thank God.
Haven't you heard? I'm the Wicked Witch of the West.
This is the work of the Wicked Witch.
Who can say I've been changed for the better? Because I knew you.
What have you done to me?
Because I knew you. Because I knew you. I have been changed.
For Good, the song, at its heart, gives voice to the rocky but deep friendship between these two girls to young women. But pulling back, the deep impulse of this story is the desire of a good-hearted white liberal to change the fortunes of and nullify the threat of a more talented, justice-seeking girl, and later young woman, of color, who's tuned into the authoritarianism of a place that looks like Candyland. In film cycles, this film's Green Witch Elphaba is the granddaughter of most of the roles played by Sidney Poitier in the Stanley Kramer civil rights films of the 1950s and 60s. Chained to a White Tony Curtis in The Defiant Ones? Same idea. The game-changing guest and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? Same idea. And the They Call Me Mr. Tibbs Philly cop who ends up in a very white Mississippi town in Norman Jewison's In the Heat of the Night? Again. Same idea. Oz is still a sweet town. Bowen Yang every so often camps his way across the screen. Jonathan Bailey from Bridgerton in one curious bit is reduced after a beatdown as Fierro, the beautiful captain of the guard, to looking like a waffle, who cheers up Elphaba, feeling blue, overlooking green. And it all still charms kids. In the good tradition of the last decades of kid films, the adults will see the 1939 layer being played with, from the completely minor details, say when the Cowardly Lion, voiced here by Coleman Domingo, appearing in the Emerald City with Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Dorothy in front of Jeff Goldblum's wizard, clutches his tail exactly the way Burt Lahr did 86 years ago. This layering extends all the way up to what really happened when the original Wicked Witch, Margaret Hamilton, melted away at the end, doused by a bucket of water, a fate awaiting Erivo's witch here, just given a tweak. The original novel in 1900 was about pluck. Pluck was in the air. Teddy Roosevelt would become president in 1901, and the novel's Dorothy caught the can-do spirit of what T.R. would come to symbolize as the dawning of the American century. A runaway bestseller at the time, the book and later the 1939 film were both candy-colored wishes. The 39 film was also about pluck, but in a world that felt as if it had no future. On the surface of Wicked for Good, it upends our understanding of the characters in Baum's original story. It rewrites them as different characters than we thought they were, something we never much thought about when we were watching the annual replay of The Wizard of Oz on network television. At the core of this two-part Wicked and Wicked for Good is a liberal vision about race, or more exactly, skin color. Ariana Grande's Glinda the Good Witch is a cherry vanilla cheerleader, or make that Emerald City influencer, who lacks witchcraft but has a good heart and oodles of political charm for munchkins. Underneath the Wicked Project is the story of a change agent, Elphaba, invited in and opting out. Can't be more up to the minute than that. And I'm Harlan Jacobson for WBGO.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO at WBGO.org.